So first of all, we're dedicating today's learning to the yahrzeit today of Shendel Bas Reb Avram, whose 16th yahrzeit is today. That's the grandmother of our very own Dina Halpern. And this is a loving grandmother who dedicated herself to providing the type of education that we're benefiting from right here, meaning the inspiration and the guidance that we gain from the teachings of Chassidus. So it's a very fitting tribute for the yahrzeit that today's study of Tanya should be in her merit. Again, Shendel Bas Reb Avram, and the Shama should have an aliyah. So we're continuing chapter 29, and with God's help, I think we're going to finish chapter 29. If nobody distracts me with any interesting diversions or side topics. No, we're pretty good at keeping on track. Okay, so just to review, since chapter 26, we've been speaking about the importance of joy and the danger of falling into negative emotional states. And we've addressed various different types of negative emotional states and the troubleshooting guide for each one of them. Because depending on the cause, the solution is different. Yeah? Sounds familiar so far without going into... I'm not going to go into the different types of negative stuff, the guilt, the shame. I'm not going to get into that, but because we've done that already. But I'm just giving context. So chapter 29, which is the chapter we're on now, we started to speak about a very specific type of emotional dysfunction, which is different than what we spoke about before. What we spoke about before is sort of all in the category of sadness. But this is in the category of apathy, which is not even sadness. It's a lack of, feeling. It's not a bad feeling, it's a lack of feeling. And we said that's actually the most dangerous condition. Apathy is the most dangerous condition. And because it's the most dangerous condition, we said it warrants a really, really intense and severe approach to counter it. So do you remember I gave literally, I think, like 20 disclaimers that the methods we're studying right now are emergency methods. Does this sound familiar? Yeah? I made it very clear. The intensity and the harshness and the brutality of these methods is not something we do on a regular basis at all. It's an emergency measure. Was that abundantly clear so far?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And specifically, what is this harsh, brutal method that's only warranted in an emergency situation? We said that it's called, well, metaphorically, it's like the log that won't catch fire. This was the metaphor from the Zohar. The log that won't catch fire, so you smash it up until it turns into splinters, and then it will catch fire. So we said it's like the ego that's complacent because it feels, my life's manageable, everything's good, I don't need anything. So we systematically break down that ego through being what's called Mari de Chushmana, a master of accounts, where we do this really, really thorough and invasive spiritual audit, and we force our ego to be confronted with its own dysfunction. And it's harsh, it's unflinching. It's merciless, but the point of it is to break down the ego, just like smashing up that log so it can catch fire. We're breaking up that ego so that it can get inspired again with spiritual light and warmth. This is all review so far. This all sounds familiar. I mean, and if you weren't here, it doesn't sound familiar, but if you were here, does it sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. So a really great question came up at the end of last week. Somebody said, okay, this sounds absolutely dreadful, but if this is what's necessary, I'll do it. Yeah. Like, I don't think this sounds fun. I wouldn't sign up for this just because I'm bored, but you're telling me that there's blockage, or there could be blockage, and it's standing in the way of me being properly inspired, if this is what's required, then I'll do it. But then there was like a second question to that question, which is, I don't even trust myself that I could administer the process because I think I'll just talk my way out of it, and I'll rationalize and tell myself, oh, things are not so bad. So I basically said, okay, let's come back to that. So here's what I want to do again. I'm not kicking the can down the road. What I want to do is say, let's come back to that at the end of today. Not right now. I don't want to start with the answer to that question. I want to lead up to that answer. Only because I believe that my answer will make more sense after we finish the chapter. Okay? All right. So we got up to the monologue where you're raging at yourself and you're screaming at your own. I mean, the Tanya technical term is nefesh habamis, the animal soul. But in English, you could just call it the ego. We had that monologue where we're raging at ourselves. It's really, it's an act of self-humiliation. And again, for the 21st time, it's brutal and we don't normally speak this way. Okay, so let's continue right after that monologue. We're up to Vihine al yidei zeh yoyol lenafshehu elikis. That through this monologue, this raging, this will assist the godly soul. Those who are new to Tanya, this is basic Tanya. We have the animal soul and the godly soul. Two personae vying for control within us. So this raging at the animal soul will allow or help the godly soul lahoyer ene be'emes yichodar einsof b'riyachushes v'loy b'chines shmiyo v'avon alavado, to be able to perceive the real truth of the oneness of God, and to see it, he says, to really see it, not just to hear it. Meaning hearing is, you know, they say seeing is believing. So hearing means, oh, in theory, it sounds like a good idea. Okay, I believe you. But seeing is, I've seen it for myself. This is a fact. I've experienced it. It's not just information, it's an experience. So basically the outcome of this really brutal self-humiliation process is that it removes all the blockages, and then, I'm able to experience godliness. He says that this is explained elsewhere, that this is actually the quintessence of all service of God. Is what? The ability to really personally experience this fact of God's oneness, not just as an abstract construct. Okay. Now he continues and explains something very interesting. He explains the underlying mechanics of why this works. We don't really understand yet why this works. In other words, we know that there's a blockage, and we said that that's due to the complacency of the ego. We know how to remove the blockage, and that's by humiliating the ego, by forcing it to own up to all of its defects. But why does that guarantee that once we do that process, it's going to make way for some type of God consciousness and spiritual sensitivity? Like, who says that's the outcome? So you remove the blockage, who says that the good stuff's going to come and fill its place? So now he's going to explain the mechanics of why it works. He says, Vahatam, the reason. Lefisha be'emes ein shum mamashes klal besitra achra. The truth is that negativity, which we call the sitra achra, the other side, has no mamashes, has no substance. Has no substance. Evil does not have any inherent existence. It's being propped up as part of a plan, but it itself has no inherent worth or value. Shalachin nimshlo lecheshech. That's why we compare it to darkness. She'en bei shuma moshes klal. Darkness has no substance. Umemela nidchem ipnei ya'ir, and therefore it's automatically pushed away by the light. Now you're going to say light has no substance either, it's intangible. Yeah, I don't mean physical substance. I mean that darkness isn't even a thing, it's an absence of something. And that's why he says darkness is automatically pushed away by the light. We don't tend to think about this very often, but how long does it take to fill a room with light? We don't think about it. If you come in this very room, this library here, in the summertime when the AC hasn't been on and it's hot, how long does it take for the room to cool off? You turn on the AC, how long does it take for the room to fill the room with cool air? It takes a while. Okay, but if you come in here and it's been dark, and even if it's been dark for days, and you flip on the light switch, how long does it take for the room to fill up with light? So, evil is called darkness for many reasons, but one reason is because of its property of being instantly displaced by holiness. Bekacha sitra achra av sheish bo chayis har be lahach yis kol balei chayim at tamein v'naf sheis umasa elam v'gam nef shebam shbisro kinis kala el. So too, the negative energy, what we call sitra achra, even though it appears to have a lot of vitality, and it's enlivening all the things in this world, basically everything other than the godly soul. It's enlivening all the living beings and all of humanity, and even the animal soul of the Jew, which is basic human impulses and desires. Basically everything other than the godly soul is being animated by this other side. And we said before, there are gradations within the other side. It's not all diabolical evil. It's the table is called the other side. I mean, maybe not this table because we learned so much Torah at it, but, you know, a piece of kosher food that's just neutral is called the other side. Unless you eat it and then you burn the calories to serve God and then it becomes holiness. But see chapter 7 or go back and watch the recording of chapter 7 if you want to understand that. So he says, even though this negative energy, this non-godly energy, seems to be so powerful because, after all, it's enlivening so much. Mikol Moke, nevertheless, Hare Kol Chayusa Eina Mitzan Atzmech Chas V'Shalom, it doesn't have its own inherent life force. Ela Mitzad HaKedusha K'nis Gleil, it's only getting what it receives from the forces of holiness, which is why when there is that situation where it's finally displaced by holiness, it's instantaneous. Like the metaphor of darkness being instantly displaced by light. There's only one thing, that internally in the human being, Nosinlok HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rishus V'Yecheles, Hashem gave special permission to this darkness, Lagbia Atzma Kenegdo, to lift itself up, meaning to put up a more of an intimidating posture. Kedei Shehadim Yiseir L'Iskaber Oleh, so the person should fight back. Lashpila Yidei Shiflus V'Nimichas Ruchai V'Nivza Be'en of Nimos. So the person should have to fight back against this internal darkness, or this internal manifestation of darkness, by lowering himself, by lowering his own ego, as we've been explaining, Ube Isirusa De La Sate, Isirusa De La Ela, and then what the person does internally, in microcosm, personally, then there's a reciprocal effect universally in the macrocosm, like it says in next week's Haftorah, actually, next week, yeah, that if the Yetzirah will act haughty like an eagle, Hashem will swat it down from there. The Hainu Shemesira Mimshalta v'yacholta, Hashem will remove it from its rulership. Masalak mimena akeich reshush shenitin lo lag bi'atzmak neged oyer kedushas nefesh elokis. Hashem will remove from it its the permission that it was given to lift itself up and to act all haughty in front of the holiness of the godly soul. And then automatically it becomes nullified, just like dark before light. Okay. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Good question. Okay, I don't know. I have to think about it. All right. Sometimes you take from one source to another source. I don't know. I can't process it quickly enough. But it's a good question. But let's stick within this context. He's explaining something very simple. He just wants you to know, because we built up this whole problem. We built up the problem of this negativity. And we made it very sort of intimidating. So he's saying, don't really be so intimidated, because you should understand that essentially this negative energy isn't its own energy. It's borrowed energy. The minute it becomes exposed to the holy side, which is really its source, because it doesn't have its own autonomous existence, it disappears. What he's basically explaining to you is that, and he's going to continue to elaborate, the reason that this process that we've been describing is effective is because we're really just sort of pulling the curtain back and exposing the truth. The truth is, although it feels like it's a really intimidating, oppressive force, it doesn't have any actual staying power. It's being propped up. And therefore, when you bring the light in, metaphorically, it will automatically disappear. You don't have to engage in this. This is not something you have to get dirty and fight with and roll around on the ground with. If you bring the truth in, then everything will sort of fall into place instantaneously. And the truth, what's the truth? The truth is that Hashem is everywhere and Hashem is right here. And the fact that I was blind to that, meaning my ego had carved out a little place for myself to feel autonomous, That was delusional. And I can sort of pop the balloon on that delusion rather quickly. I guess what he's saying is, to get in there, to be able to be poised to pop that balloon, that's sort of a brutal process. But then once you do it, you disabuse yourself of that notion rather quickly. And you realize, you know, that this narrative that the ego is telling you is totally ridiculous. It's patently ridiculous. There's no truth to it. It was telling you, you know, I'm okay and I can have my own agenda. I can do what I want and I don't have to always think about Hashem. And here I'm okay and I'm a religious Jew and I'm able to just basically do whatever, not whatever I want, I'm not going to do it. Because remember, we were describing the guy at the beginning of the chapter. His problem wasn't that he was sinning. He wasn't sinning, God forbid. He just wasn't getting inspired. And he was okay with the fact he wasn't getting inspired, which is sort of the definition of not being inspired. Being okay with not being inspired is sort of the definition of not being inspired. So we had to get rid of that. How do we get rid of it? How do we get rid of it is a brutal process, but the culmination of it, once it's done, once the process is done, remember we spoke about, you talk to yourself about your past, and you talk to yourself even about your dreams, and all the dirt you can drum up on yourself to sort of break the arrogance of the ego and to force it to admit its weakness. there is a breaking point. And once that breaking point comes, that whole illusion topples really quickly. Okay? You know what were you going to say? Yeah, so we're not really talking about temptation here. I mean, that's a different type of darkness. And he spoke about that, you know, in chapter 13. He said that the animal soul is getting stronger during our entire lifetime. We have to always stay a step ahead of it. But here we're talking about something very specific. We're talking about a very specific lie that the ego tells us, which is, this is not about temptation. You know what? Let me tell you something. If this guy were battling with temptation, we wouldn't be doing this brutal technique on him. And I'll tell you why. Because somebody who's feeling temptation, so there's passion. We can work with passion. We can redirect passion. This chapter 29 is talking about somebody, there's no passion. He's feeling emotionally dead, which we said is even more dangerous. There's a different type of darkness or a different... I don't know if the darkness is different, but it's a different experience of darkness. And specifically, it presents itself in the form of a lie that you can be complacent, you can be comfortable. And as long as you're doing what you're supposed to be doing and checking off the boxes, you don't have to feel excited. You don't have to be inspired. And that's what the guy's doing. This is a religious guy in this chapter. He's not doing any sins. Yeah, he's numb. Yeah.
Is this person operating at that point when going to...
Say again?
Sorry. Is this person operating in the medium of thought? No. The garment of thought rather than speech or action? Like, how is he telling himself? Is it...
I don't even know if it's an act of thought.
It's not even an...
It's just a belief.
So it's all in the thought process.
I don't know if it's an act of thought. It might not be a conscious thought. It might just be a subconscious belief.
But in order to pop the darkness...
Yes.
Does one have to use speech and action, or is one...
Well, we described it. We described the process of breaking through it. Yes. We said that it's sort of like self-talk. So remember that process of that intervention that you do. It's self-talk.
But would it have to be self-talk where you are actually allowed talking to yourself so you could hear yourself?
I don't know. I don't. I'm not sure it is or isn't. It could be completely in your head. But he definitely, I mean, he gives you a script. Remember the monologue?
Yeah.
So it definitely is self-talk. I don't know if you have to say it out loud or you just think it in your mind, but definitely is self-talk. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... what is the source of the negative force, and does this go to the root? I mean, it never goes to the root of it, so it never really takes
well,
it totally out.
Well, he's, yeah. What he's saying, you're saying it doesn't get to the root of the darkness, but what he's saying, ironically, is the root of the darkness is light, because the darkness has no independent existence.
When you break it down, you take away the outside, and it's connected to
right,
the light.
And that's why he's explaining how the
doesn't stay,
the truth will automatically be revealed. When the lie is exposed, the truth doesn't have to be brought in from somewhere else. He's going to continue to explain. Let's continue in the text.
What is the truth?
The truth is that God is everywhere, God is everything, and even right here in this place, and that there's no separation from him. And that I can't go carve out my own little place of autonomy, even if I barter with God and promise to be a religious Jew in exchange for him not bothering me. You like that deal? I'll be frum and you just stay off my back.
All right. But he also won't get his protection and guidance.
Yeah, so you negotiate. Watch me closely enough that I don't get hurt, but not too closely that... I have to feel self-conscious. Yeah. Okay, but let's continue here, because he explains more about this truth. Okay. An incredible vart about a story in Chumash. It's actually my bar mitzvah parsha, Parsha Shlach. That's why I always connect to this piece right here. Shemitchila amru, that at the beginning they said, Ki chazaku mimenu, al tikri mimenu, chulu, shalo yaminu b'yechilas Hashem. First they said, we can't invade the land, we can't conquer the land, because the inhabitants of the land are stronger than God. You remember that? Uh-huh. They didn't believe in the ability of God to conquer them. But then afterwards, later on, they're like, okay, let's do it. Let's go. Let's go. Remember that whole story? They came back. They said, we can't do it. And then Moshe Rabbeinu told them, oh, this is a terrible thing. This is a tragedy. It was Tisha B'Av, actually. He says, this is going to be a bad precedent. And it was. And then later on, they were like, okay, let's go. Let's do it. And he was like, no, you blew it. Too late. Too late. Okay. So the Alter Rebbe asks, U'mayayin chazro v'olahem amon b'yichelez Hashem, where did they suddenly get renewed faith in God? Haraylei hera lohem, Meisha Rabbeinu olav shalom shum eisu meifes al zeb in tzayim. Meisha didn't show them any miracles at that time. Rak shamalahem ein eich shekatzav Hashem alayhem v'nish b'shalei levi amela aritz. The only thing is, Meisha told them, Hashem's mad at you and he's not going to bring you into the land. Uma ha'il zelahem, what would that help? Im loy ha'yu ma'amina b'yechelos Hashem chas v'shalom lich b'shalam ad alef melachim. If they didn't believe Hashem was capable of conquering the 31 Canaanite nations, mim nezel loy ratzu klal likonis l'aritz, and because of that, they didn't want to enter, they didn't want to attempt to enter the land. So then, how all of a sudden are they going to have a change of heart if Moshe Rabbeinu says to them, okay, we're not going to allow you to do that which you already believe you can't do. Okay, so then, great, that's what I want. I wanted to not go into the land. And now, what's my punishment? That I don't have to go into the land. Why did they suddenly have a change of heart? Say, no, let's go into the land. It's funny. It's a good question. Now, if you would tell them, look, I'm going to show you a miracle, and just like Hashem has the power to make this miracle, he has the power to conquer the 31 Canaanite kings. Oh, okay, so you're boosting their confidence. Maybe they'll get some faith going. But if they didn't have faith, which is precisely the reason why they didn't want to enter the land, because they were lacking faith, then how come all of a sudden they said, like, we can do it? Well, where did they get that faith from? Where did that faith come from? Nothing was done to infuse them with faith, to win their confidence.
So are we saying lack of apathy is the same as lack of faith?
No, the opposite. Lack of apathy is faith. Or say apathy is lack of faith.
Yeah.
Is it the same as saying, like, don't touch and then you touch?
Like being contrarian? Yeah, but here's the thing. A person will be contrarian about something that not going to get them killed. If they thought they were going to get killed by going into the land, now all of a sudden, reverse psychology makes them say, oh, let's go get ourselves killed. Okay, like, reverse psychology works to a point. But the Alter Rebbe is asking a question. They didn't have any faith. They said, we can't do it. We cannot enter the land. It's not going to work. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, fine, so we're not entering the land. They said, no, we could do it. We could do it. The Alter Rebbe is just asking, where did they get the faith from? Where'd they get the faith? He's going to answer the question right here. Elavadai, mipnei sheYisrael atzmon hei ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. But the absolutely clear truth, the certain truth is, the Jewish people are ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. They're inherent believers. Meaning to say, the natural setting of the Jewish people is to believe in Hashem. That's natural. That's instinctive. It's just that the negativity within them, which is invested in their bodies, had reared its head and sort of blocked that off, and it acts in a way that's characteristically insolent He calls it chutzpah, without any, bli tam vadas, without any rationale. Meaning, inherently I'm a believer, but I have this element within me that's able to just irrationally oppose that without even any good arguments, and block off my faith, or block me off from my faith. V'lochin, therefore, miyad shekatzef Hashem aleim, immediately when Hashem got mad at them, v'hirim bekel rash v'regiz, and screamed at them, or Moshe screamed at them, admosai la'edo hara hazeis v'gemer, how long will this evil congregation, b'midbar hazeh yiplu pigrechem v'gemer, then the curse, you guys are going to die in this wilderness. Ani Hashem debarti im lo'i zeis esa l'chol la'edo hara hazeis v'gemer, Hashem made an oath, I'm going to do this to this generation, meaning you're all going to be punished, you're not going to enter the land. When they heard such harsh words, nichne v'nishbar libam bikirbam, they were subjugated and their hearts were broken within them. K'dechsiv v'yis'ablu ha'am me'ed, like it says, the nation was grieving a lot. Memela then, and here's the important word, memela, automatically. Memela automatically nafla sitra'achal m'mshalta v'gavchusa v'gasas rucha. The negativity fell from its power and authority and its arrogance. V'Yisrael atzmam heim maminim, and the Jews themselves were restored to their inherent state of belief. Yeah.
I don't think that's so like magical. It's like if you're afraid that to go and fight,
it's not magical.
You might die. Exactly. And then you're told, oh well, if you stay here, you'll die anyway. So they're like, okay, I'll take death that way over death. Mm. Meaning they were traded death for death. Like they were afraid to go there. They didn't have faith because they thought they'd die. Now they're being told they're going to die in the desert. They're like, okay, we may as well give it a shot to go there.
Yeah, but this is like, what's the difference? Like getting killed in hand-to-hand combat or dying in a nursing home? I mean, they weren't told they're going to get, like...
No, but it's like, we all have paths in life. They were like...
Oh, yeah, he says you're going to die eventually.
Both paths are death. Okay, I might as well try that one.
Eventually, they're going to pass away in that generation, in the wilderness. It doesn't mean they're going to get violently murdered on a battlefield. I mean, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but...
No. Being stabbed in the belly and a slow death.
Yeah, it's not pleasant, yeah. Anyways, but he's explaining the fact that it's an interesting story where they had no faith, and then they did have faith, and we're asking ourselves, well, what happened in between the lack of faith and the infusion of faith? Like, where did that faith come from? So if you're going to tell me, Moshe Rabbeinu sat them down, and he said, look, I want to show you some proofs. He gave them a whole slideshow, and explain to them, here's the history, and here's what God did for us. Oh, remember the 10 plagues, or maybe even make some new miracles. Oh, so that's how they got some new faith. They got pumped up in their faith. But what we're saying is, they didn't need to get any new faith. They always had faith. Even at the time when they were being cynics and scoffers, they had faith. It was just blocked off from them. And what blocks it off from us? The ego. So if you remove the ego, you automatically reveal the faith. And how do we remove the ego? So far, what we've been saying in chapter 29 is through this brutal process of self-examination, through scrutiny, taking ourselves to task about, like we said, that whole inventory. And it sort of exposes the dysfunction of the animal soul, and it has to admit to its unmanageability. And then once that happens, once it's defeated, then all the faith that was always there can come shining. Okay, that's what he's saying.
But Rabbi, yeah. Isn't it more the phrase of punishment, severe punishment of kares, that prompted that realization?
The punishment was that God was mad at them. He makes it very clear. It's not about the punishment, it's that God is mad at you. Can we grow up for a second here? Do you care if your mother grounds you for a week, or she takes away your phone, or she, I don't know what punishments parents do today.
But, this is
but
serious.
The point is, I am being serious. Listen to me.
Take away the
book. Or if your mother
stops talking to you.
Is mad at you. Maybe she even talks to you, but you see, she's not happy.
What if she throws you out of the house?
Then you get a new life.
So that's confusing, though.
Listen to what I'm saying. We're not children here. Your mother's mad at you. That should shake you up more than any consequence that she could drum up.
Then they did tshuva, and they were still denied access. And I thought, why?
Okay, so that's another. Now you're asking. Now you're getting into a whole this discussion about that story. But we're just looking. This is not a Parsha Shlach Parsha class. We're looking at one little story that happened, or slice of a story, because it's an interesting phenomenon, and the Alter Rebbe is examining it, and he's saying, please explain to me what accounts for the fact that a group of Jews lacked faith in a pretty serious way. The God who took them out of Egypt and did plagues and split the sea told them, let's go into the land, and they were like, no, we can't do it. No, it was worse than that. You can't do it. They told God, he's not able to do it. And then the next day they're like, okay, let's do it. He's asking a very interesting question. What accounts for that major shift? So he says, well, that's just a very clear illustration of the fact that the underlying state, the innate state of the Jewish people, is they do believe in God, and that there are merely interpositions, things that get caked on, crud, spiritual crud that gets caked on, and it's blocking the light. So you just got to knock it off. You got to dislodge it. But once you dislodge it, the faith was always there. You don't have to go out and get the faith. This is the point that he's making here.
But wasn't the question what prompted that?
And I told you, God's mad at us. That's it. It doesn't matter what the punishment is. It matters. God's mad at us.
And it was the actual screaming, right? It was like the same, the breaking, the splinter.
Yeah, well, yeah, Moshe did scream at them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a Jew's automatic default is faith, emunah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's a non-Jew's automatic default?
Rationality. Human beings are rational. Human beings are programmed for survival.
So Jews don't.
It's evolutionarily advantageous. What? Well, Jews have a second programming as well, called the godly soul, which is totally irrational and not conducive to survival, which is the miracle of Jewish continuity, that we have a programming that is actually counter to survival. The godly soul would rather physically die than to betray God. And any nation who has that program really shouldn't survive through thousands of years, let alone with all the persecution that the Jewish people have been subjected to. That's
Does that
a miracle.
Have a name, that second program?
The godly soul. It's called the godly soul. When I say it's evolutionarily advantageous, I hope everyone knows I'm saying it tongue-in-cheek. I say it because those who would make this argument that, well, what I'm saying is anyone who's a secular or even atheistic believer in the origin of the species, according to Darwin, which is pretty much ubiquitously accepted today. Not me. I mean, I'm an extremist and a fundamentalist, so I don't accept it. But they would be comfortable with that statement. So I'm just letting you know. I'm not saying anything that 99% of intelligent people would have any problem with. They could find other things to argue with me, but I don't think there's anything. I don't think anything disruptive to their own worldview for me to say that human beings are programmed to be rational and to make decisions that are advantageous for the propagation of the species. So that's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. I don't know if anyone followed that, but it's okay. All right. Yeah.
Can I ask about this, or is it off topic?
What about evolution? No, I don't want to talk
before
about Darwin.
That. No, but like other religions will also, like,
let's say, sacrifice or put their religion before the rationale.
Yeah, you know, you're right. Oh. And he talks about it in chapter 19. Who remembers chapter 19? Remember when he speaks about the natural love that we have of Hashem and activating the natural love? So it's interesting over there in chapter 19.
Denizens?
What?
The Denizens?
No, that was chapter 9. Oh. Chapter 19.
Secular people.
Right. So he identifies a very strange phenomenon throughout Jewish history of irreligious Jews who sacrificed their lives for their Jewish identity. So the idea of a religious person giving their life up for the religion, it happens universally. But there's this peculiar phenomenon, which is rather unfortunately frequent throughout Jewish history in many, many different places, many different times. And that is Jews who are not religious, even irreligious, but when it comes to renouncing the Jewish identity, they won't allow themselves to do it. Now, of course, you're going to say, "What? There were exceptions. What about the Muranos in Spain?" Don't ask me about the exceptions to that. To ask me why it even happened once. Okay, once you could say is an anomaly, but why did it happen so often? So the Alter Rebbe points to that as a peculiarity of the Jewish people, and says it's basically this irrational drive of the godly soul. Yeah. So we have principled people who die for their ideology. What's weird is we have Jews who seemingly their whole life they couldn't be bothered to inconvenience themselves to be observant Jews, but then when it comes to the pain of death and torture, all of a sudden, you know, like a Daniel Pearl situation, all of a sudden they become so Jewish, like that becomes the only thing that matters to them. So that's a little bit strange. Anyways, what we're saying, that's a related idea, it's related. But what we're saying here is, the godly soul, I want to move on because I do want to answer the question that we started with the beginning of the class. The godly soul innately is in a state of active faith. And if you are not experiencing that, it's not that you've lost it, it's that something's interrupting it. You know, the lights are always on, but maybe there's something on top of the light that needs to be removed. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
So what we'll say apathy is lack of faith.
Apathy, well, causes lack of faith, yeah. Okay, let's continue. Okay. Umezeh yachol lilmoid kol adam sheneflim lai b'machshavtei sfeikas al amuna. From this, anyone who experiences doubts of faith can learn a very important lesson. Ki hem divir ruch ha-sitra achra levada. Don't worry about it. It's just the sitra achra. Ha-magbiya atma al-nafshei, which is lifting itself up arrogantly against you. Al-yisra atma he-maminim chulu, but you, inherently, you are still a believer. Ve-gama sitra achra atma, and also, you should know, the sitra achra itself Ain Los Fakus. So here you're going to, chapter 9 that you're referring to, here you're going to have a little chapter 9 reference. Tell me if anyone remembers a chapter 9 reference. You want to know something else kind of weird? This negative entity that is programmed to confuse and distract us from the truth, it itself is not confused. It was given permission, meaning its job is to confuse people with falsehood. And the reason is to give the person more reward, more resistance, more reward. You lift more weight, you get stronger. Like the harlot seducing the king's son with the permission of the king, like it's written in the holy Zohar. Where did we have that earlier in Tanya? Do you remember? That piece of Zohar was referenced earlier in Tanya.
Chapter 9.
Chapter 9, at the very end of chapter 9.
I read the footnotes.
Okay, that's fair game. Reading the footnotes is fair game. That's very good. Yeah, remember at the end of chapter 9, he said, well, in chapter 9 he was describing the condition of the tzaddik, where the godly soul had completely conquered the small city And that means that the godly soul was dominating all of the person's emotions and behavioral choices. And then at the very end of chapter 9, it says, and what is the animal soul trying to do? Its agenda is to achieve the exact opposite, that the person should be completely dominated emotionally and behaviorally by his animalistic drive. And then at the very end, it says, but even when the animal soul is pushing for this agenda, it's only really ultimately for the benefit of the person that the person should overcome it, like the metaphor of the harlot contracted by the king to test the king's son. Meaning that the harlot wants the son of the king to resist. But in order to do her job, she has to, she can't betray the fact that she really wants him to resist. So she has to go all out. But really, that's not what she wants. So even this internal voice that's coming to us and telling us all types of crazy lies to make us lose our faith, we don't ever lose our faith, lose contact with our faith. Even this crazy voice that's coming and telling us these crazy lies to make us lose contact with our faith, it itself knows that that is a lie. And why is this important information? Who cares? Why is this important information?
Because this also comes from Hashem, right?
Yeah, well, yes. And why is that important to know that?
Be ready for it.
To be ready, to be prepared?
Because even when you have no feelings, when you're apathetic, it makes sense.
Even the light doesn't believe in its own light. So that's
okay,
little,
that's the
comforting
truth.
Oh,
comforting.
It's
okay.
For you
okay.
To go and
that's the word that I wanted.
Light.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why it's important.
What?
It's comforting.
What's comforting?
This fact, knowledge of this fact. You should know that even when you're in this situation, that even when you're in a situation where you feel you've lost your connection, you've lost your spiritual connection, where you're doubting everything, and you're not feeling an ease in your relationship with Hashem, you should know that condition itself was manufactured by Hashem, that he appointed this agent with a specific task, and this is all part of the relationship with Hashem. It's not outside of your relationship with Hashem, it's a function of your relationship with Hashem, and that even that tool that Hashem is using to ostensibly undermine your faith is not an independent operator that can spiral out of control and really lead you astray. The whole thing is completely under control. It's all under control. Yeah.
Doesn't it refer to someone who is from, who is going through the motions but is not feeling anything?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So the animal soul is in that person actually conforming to what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In the godly soul. The godly soul is actually it is in control.
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah.
It's the feeling that the person.
Correct. Yes. Yes.
So, like with the Shlach episode.
Okay, there it was much worse. They didn't even want to do what they were supposed to do.
Exactly.
Okay, but we're using it as an illustration.
Okay, so
yeah.
What I'm saying is, though, the apathy is a feeling. It's an emotion.
Or the lack thereof, yeah.
Or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
The mind is doing what it's supposed to be doing. It's just the heart's not connected. How do you connect it?
Well, no, it is a problem in the mind, and that's why we need to flip a mental switch here. No, it's not, the symptom is emotional, the lack of emotion, but the cause is a distorted belief.
Because you're not believing.
And then we have to remove that belief, yeah. But I want to answer the question. Remember the question about Should we do this? Should we throw ourselves into this really? Because that was the end of the text today. But we have a question on the table. Should we throw ourselves into this method? Should we do it? And how do we make sure that we stick to it? Because it's going to get scary and we're going to want to tap out. Yeah, we're going to start defending ourselves and rationalizing and deflecting. Yeah. So here's what I want to tell you. This chapter of Tanya, every time I come to this chapter of Tanya, when I go through Tanya with a group, I always question whether or not I should learn it. Because in our generation, things are different. And we don't do this harsh stuff. And it's not that it doesn't necessarily work. Obviously, in the times of the Alter Rebbe, it worked. That's why he told people to do it. But in our generation, first of all, it may work, it may not work. We run a risk of it not working. And what I mean by that is, we're very weak people. There's no question. There's something called Yiridus HaDoros, the descent of the generations. And we're weaker people. We're not as robust. And we can't handle this kind of intensity. So it may just end up being unproductive because we're going to beat ourselves up, we're going to break our hearts, we're going to remove the apathy of the godly, of the animal soul, so the godly soul can rush in. Okay, fine, all well and good, but in the process, we may damage our psyche so much that we can't spring back from it. So it may actually end up just not being a productive, practically speaking, it may not be productive. But there are other reasons as well why in our generation this may not be advisable. Another reason is because the Jewish people collectively have already been through intense brutality, especially what happened in the past generation to the Jewish people, the terrible calamities that we suffered. Really, you don't kick a man when he's down. And if there was any use to the cleansing factor of the suffering. Okay, so we've had it. We did it. We've been there, done that, right? So we're not looking to do more of that. And then one more thing is we're getting closer to Mashiach, and when Mashiach comes, everything's going to be positive. And we're already shifting into the mode where we can just amplify on what's good and what's right instead of focusing on what needs to be different. So for many reasons, the juncture where we're at in history right now indicates that probably it's not advisable to employ methods like chapter 29, where the whole approach is to brutally scrutinize yourself until you're forced to just drop to your knees and admit your own dysfunction and unmanageability. On the other hand, should Lama Nigara, why should we miss out? Why should we not receive the benefit of this chapter? Okay. So, we want the benefit. We want the benefit. Of course, we want to remove the obstructions of a complacent ego so the light of faith can come rushing in. Of course we want that benefit. Why wouldn't we want that? What I'm saying is sometimes a patient comes in and you say, there is a therapy, there is a surgery, there is a medication, but I'm looking at you, and for you, it's not going to be good. It's not worth it. Or the side effects are just not
It's too risky.
So, and that's what I'm saying. First of all, we're weaker people at this juncture in history. You're going to break somebody who says they're going to spring back. I mean, once upon a time, people were very tough. Today, you're going to break somebody down, and maybe everything you're saying is true, but who says they're going to come back from that? That might just be it. That might be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and then what did you gain? Nothing. At the end of the day, we're doing this for Hashem. We want people to be able to serve Hashem better. So if somebody becomes incapacitated and he can't serve Hashem, then we gain nothing. All right. That was the first thing
so
I said.
Better to the person okay. to stay that way?
Well, I'm not saying it's better to stay that way. Well, if I only have two choices, yeah, it's better they stay that way. Yeah, Yeah, and not spiritually kill them. Okay? Maybe there are more than two choices, what I'm going to get at. Okay. But I'm just reviewing what I said before, the reasons why we don't do it in this generation. One is we're weaker people. So it's too risky. The intense brutality is too risky. Two, we've been through enough already. No more suffering for Jews. What do you want to add? You want to kick a man when he's down? You want to add more suffering to the Jewish people? No. And the third thing is we're getting close to Mashiach. And when Mashiach comes, everything will be positive. So we can already start to have a way of serving Hashem where we just build on positive things. Find what's right about ourselves and do more of that. Okay? So that's why we don't do the method that is described here. But how do we avail ourselves of the benefits of the method? Okay, so here's what I'm going to tell you. The whole purpose of this method, it wasn't for the sake of humiliation. Humiliation was just a tool, it wasn't the goal. Right? Like, unless you're a masochist, the goal wasn't humiliation. Humiliation was the means through which we achieve a goal. What was the goal?
The end result is to break down the blockage, remove the blockage.
To feel again. Okay. So the humiliation was the tool to remove the blockage, to be able to receive the light. Right.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Because really, what we heard today was that the light is inside.
Yeah. You're right. The light is inside. Right. Receiving the light doesn't mean a light from out here. It's a light from in here.
That's your default. Like the brain, the intellect is overcompensating somehow.
Well, the light actually is in the brain.
It's in the brain.
And it can't get to the heart and to the behaviors. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's the punchline. And I want to wrap up here. In today's day and age, the advised method for removing the obstructions of the ego is unbridled joy. And not because we're trying to be cute, or we're trying to, you know, because we want to make it easy for people, and oh, people like joy. What could we sell people that they would like? Oh, let's tell people what they want to hear. Trust me, you guys know me. Any of you learn with me, I'm not trying to tell you what you want to hear. I'm being very practical here. Yes, there are times we need to remove the obstruction. But if we're going to do these brutal methods of removing obstruction, we may cause more damage than it's worth, and then what do we gain? So another way we have of removing obstruction, it's very simple. You want to blast away the ego? Get up, be joyful when you have no reason for it, when you don't want to be, when it's totally irrational. And it is the most ego-reducing state, is to force yourself to act and to even feel happy in an unlimited fashion, not just a little smile, but to really just to be enthused with unbridled joy. That reduces the ego. That totally smashes the ego out of the way.
Without the assistance of drugs or alcohol.
Well, drugs and alcohol doesn't even do it. Drugs and alcohol is an attempt to simulate that. Right. Right.
People go to that because they're trying to simulate it.
Well, of course they're trying to remove the ego. Yeah, of course, self-medication is an attempt to remove the ego. That's the numbness and the distraction of self-medication is to remove the ego.
Wait, so how do we access that joy when we are in an apathetic or...
Fake it until you make it.
The same way you can force yourself to do this method and to brutalize yourself, force yourself to get up and dance. I'm not joking.
You're right. That's right. That's the right way.